The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll start the show today with an article from the Profiles section of the July 29, 2024 issue of the New Yorker. An artist flowering in her 90s. Isabelle Ducreux, a painter in Rome, didn't really pick up a brush until her 50s. Four decades later, galleries and museums throughout Europe are celebrating her work. By Rebecca Mead. For more than two decades, Isabelle Ducreux, an artist who was born in Naples in 1931, has lived in an apartment on the top floor of the Palazzo Doria Pamphilja in the center of Rome. When I knocked on her door for the first time this past spring, she greeted me with an emphatic pronouncement in English. "I must tell you immediately that I have never been so happy in my life." It was a Tuesday evening in April, and I'd landed in Rome just a few hours earlier. Originally, Ducreux and I had arranged to meet for lunch the next day. But when she learned of my schedule, she invited me to come over sooner, for a drink and a light dinner, noting in an email that she would be enchanted to see me immediately. She opened the door to the apartment, where she lived with Vittorio, Vicky, Ducreux, her husband of 58 years until his death in 2022. And I entered a spacious hallway densely hung with dark, dramatic Baroque paintings. Light shone on them from French doors that led to an expansive terrace. A side table held a vase of roses that were hovering on the edge between bloom and decay. Ducreux, who was tall and upright, grasped my hand more firmly than I would have expected, saying, "Please believe what I tell you. I adored my husband, and I am half a person now that he is not with me. But I am happy. Happy." Only in the past 5 years has Ducreux, who turned 93 in June, become internationally recognized for her art, which she didn't even begin making until she was in her 50s. When creating her works, she stands and uses a brush sometimes, attached to a stick, sweeping loose arcs of ink or paint onto paper or fabric. She often later incorporates scraps of other papers or textiles. Her painted collages usually depict ecstatic figures and stylized landscapes. Arrays of ovals or checkered patterns are a recurring feature. Typically made in series, her works are light, energetic, and uninhibitedly beautiful. Ducreux's oeuvre has been admired in Italy for three decades. In 1993, a tapestry was included in the Venice Biennale, and in 2008 and 2014, she had solo shows at the National Gallery of Modern and Contemporary Art in Rome. But it wasn't until 2019 that she was championed in earnest outside the country, when Gisella Capitaine, a gallerist in Cologne, Germany, mounted a solo show of Ducreux's work, which featured iterative images of flowers in vases, along with several pieces from a series, Bella Terra, each of them depicting a tree and a flowing river. It was as if Ducreux, in her ripe ebullience, had leapt directly into a late Matisse phase, full of color and shorn of fuss. This summer, the Consortium Museum in Dijon, France, is hosting Ducreux's first international solo museum show, heralding her, counterintuitively, as, quote, "a young artist with a young career," end quote. The exhibition includes 11 paintings, on paper, from a series that Ducreux calls Tendernesses. They show two figures exuberantly entangled amid a patchwork of pattern blocks. Secured to the gallery walls with pins, the paintings, like the blissful people depicted within them, seem to float unsupported. Since Ducreux's husband died, she has shared her apartment with her housekeeper and two cats. Apart from a daily excursion to her studio on the Palazzo's ground floor, she only occasionally leaves home. A sharp contrast to her earlier life, which was uncommonly adventurous. Vicky Ducro was the prosperous founder of a luxury travel company, Viaggi dell'Elefante, and the Ducros journeyed extensively to India, China, Laos, Myanmar, and many other countries, taking with them paying groups of well-heeled and cultured visitors, most of whom already were, or eventually became, their friends, to see architectural sites and to shop in markets. On those trips, Isabella bargained for rare and fragile textiles from merchants in places such as Kashmir and Isfahan, amassing a singular collection. Her treasures range from 17th century Tibetan prayer shawls to fragments of Egyptian cotton dating possibly to the 9th century. Vicky collected Indian miniature paintings, becoming a self-taught expert. On their travels in Yemen, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, the Ducros gathered cuttings of wild roses, transporting damp stems in their suitcases before planting them at their country house in Umbria, where they tended a garden exclusively dedicated to the genus. It still supplies flowers for Isabella's apartment. Despite her late start, and even later recognition, Ducros's artistic flowering has been immensely productive. Andrea Villani, the director of the Museo del Civita in Rome, which will exhibit a selection of Ducros's works alongside examples of historical textiles from its own collection this summer, told me Ducros is fortunate that her preferred technique and materials remain relatively easy for her to manage, compared with, say, sculpting metal or painting with oils on heavy canvases. Her work is easy to hold, and easy to paint, and easy to store, Villani said. It's very convenient that she chose something so soft. Sadie Coles, a gallerist in London who presented a solo show of Ducros's work last year and is currently hosting another, first encountered the paintings in a booth at Art Basel in 2022. She bought one of Ducros's landscapes without knowing anything about the life of the artist. My initial response was just how fresh it was, Coles told me. I would never have guessed it was made by a then 91-year-old. There's a sense of play, of texture, of discovery. Ducros's works, Coles added, feel so full of sex, intimacy, and erotic charge. In an introduction to a catalog about the Tendernesses series, the Italian scholar Emanuele D'Attilo writes that people are frequently amazed to discover that the creator of such explicitly sensual works is, quote, a lady who is well over the age of 80, end quote. Of course, this reaction reveals as much about the limitation of the observer's imagination as it does about the voluptuous reaches of Ducros. We tend to assign to the elderly, and especially to elderly women, the vague and often diminishing attribute of wisdom, thereby suggesting that their own creative, intellectual, or erotic evolution has come to an end, and that their sole remaining role is to give advice to others. Ducros's work and life offer an alternative possibility, that an individual might remain wide-eyed and open to experience. In an enduring state of naivete and with a capacity to be joyfully surprised until the very end. The Palazzo Doria Pamphilia, which was constructed over several centuries and occupies most of a block, remains the home of the aristocratic family for whom it is named. The clan's most prominent member, Pope Innocent X, was immortalized by Velázquez in a celebrated portrait painted around 1650. This masterpiece is still on display at the Palazzo, in one of several splendidly ornate rooms downstairs that show off the family's art collection. On our first evening together, Ducros welcomed me into her apartment's unfolding series of cozy, inviting rooms, which were filled with overstuffed sofas, art deco armchairs, and modernist tables by Alvar Aalto. Choice ceramics and glassware were arranged on mantels and tables. There was a yellow ceramic dish by Picasso, a white glazed Ecce Homo made by Ducros' son Giuseppe, a sculptor who specializes in religious iconography, and a medieval Islamic dish showing a rider on horseback, a gift from her other child, Enrico, who now runs the travel business. Art works by friends hung on the walls. There was a portrait of Ducros from about 40 years ago by Mado Gorki, the daughter of Archil Gorki, and a 1977 pastel drawing of a lotus flower by Cy Twombly, who, along with his aristocratic wife, Tatiana Franchetti, often traveled with the Ducros. The Twombly is inscribed for Isabella. There were also dozens more Baroque paintings, many dating to the 17th century and acquired in the 1980s and 90s, when such works were unfashionable. A shadowy, thorn-crowned Christ being taunted by a muscled thug, attributed to Annibale Carracci, hung in Vicky Ducros' still-intact bedroom. The prize of the collection, a pallid, recumbent, half-naked Cleopatra by Artemisia Gentileschi, was on loan to a museum, leaving a ghostly rectangle of space on a wall near the kitchen, where a litter box was discreetly positioned. Ducros asked her housekeeper, Shanti Wijesundara, to pour us glasses of champagne, and we settled side by side on a sofa. She wore an oversized olive-green sweater, wide-legged black satin pants, and chunky pale pink sneakers. Her hair was white and cut in a blunt, chin-length bob with a center part, and around her neck she wore a gold chain with a pendant of green glass. She was chic and easy in her manner. But life at her age is far from effortless, she said. Since Vicky's death, Ducros has been increasingly dependent on Wijesundara, who has worked for her for 40 years. She washes me, Ducros told me at one point. I am completely in her hands. As we sipped our champagne, Ducros explained that the happiness she felt was not unqualified. I am terrified also, naturally, because friends of mine, old people, are dying, she said. But happiness is another thing. I think I am helped by the words that come to me. Words are more generous with me now. Though Ducros is best known for her paintings, she has also flourished, belatedly, as a writer of essays and short stories in The Checkered Cloth, published in English translation in 2019. Ducros analyzes a painting of the Annunciation by Simone Martini, the 14th century Sienese artist. Ever a connoisseur of textiles, she focuses on the exposed lining of the angel Gabriel's fluttering cloak, which has a checkered pattern. A design that, she argues, has long been associated with women, children, and the insane, rather than with heavenly visitation. In 22 Places of the Soul, published in 2022, Ducros dilates on the triune nature of fabric, describing the warp, the weft, and the empty space trapped between them as a metaphor for the Holy Trinity. Elsewhere, she compares weaving to the generative union of masculine and feminine. Every morning, between 8:30 and 10:30, Ducros writes before descending to her studio. During the day, I am absolutely normal, she said. But in the morning, I write very intelligent things. Dinner consisted of traditional Neapolitan food, lightly fried arancini with tomato sauce, followed by a savory pie. We ate around a coffee table instead of at her formal dining table, which is more frequently used for laying out her larger works of art. Ducros keeps it covered with a canvas tablecloth that she has painted with red and white stripes, rather than cleaning it when it gets dirty, She simply adds another layer of paint. The meal was the first of several that I shared with her that week. One visitor after another came by, creating an ever-evolving salon. I met her sons, both of whom live in Rome, her older brother, Paolo, who is 96 and still walks through her apartment from his home near the Piazza Navona, their younger sister, Shazi, who is 91, lives in Naples. Two of Ducro's four grandchildren, a tax law advisor and friend of more than 30 years, who traveled with the Ducros multiple times, and a new art dealer friend whom Ducro had warmly absorbed into her circle. All were greeted with porcelain cups of scented tea or chilled champagne in pretty colored glasses. We also spent many hours alone, during which Ducro was irreverent, confiding, and emotional. Our conversation interrupted only by the occasional wailing of one of her cats, Evita, a diminutive ancient creature who stiffly roamed the apartment as if lost. "She is the same age as me," Ducro said in a low voice. The cat sometimes unleashed a penetrating yowl that reminded Ducro of her husband's final days. "He approached death furiously," she said. Having witnessed that, she was bracing for similar anguish herself. "I will be more near to Vicky," she said, explaining that she didn't mean this in a supernatural way. Although she was devoutly Catholic in her girlhood, she no longer believes in an afterlife. She meant that after a long life with Vicky, she would feel a fitting sympathy with him at the end. "Love is produttivo. Love produces love," she said. It became clear that although Ducro's late arriving fame has gratified her, it is also, in a way, meaningless. Adam Weinberg, a former director of the Whitney Museum, is planning a big exhibition of her work at the Madri, a museum of contemporary art in Naples, in collaboration with the Madri's director, Eva Fabris. This hometown retrospective, the honor of a lifetime for a younger artist, is scheduled for 2026, and is therefore not something that it makes sense for Ducro to anticipate. "Oh, it's too far away," she told me. Her words reminded me of the final paragraph in Women's Life, a slim memoir that she published in 2021, which I had just reread on the flight to Rome. It states, "At this stage of life, you can no longer lie. You cannot help but say things that are true. Why the etiquette of silence, the prudence of propriety? You must howl if you seek propriety, consistency, and accuracy. Let the truth be sobbed out. Gentle has my time been flowing, whispering to me without malice, there is no tomorrow, there is no tomorrow." When I reminded her of this passage, she said, "That's very true. Yesterday I said, I hope that Rebecca is coming before I die. This is very logical. I live in a kind of metaphysical way. I am already in another dimension." Ducro grew up in Montedidio, a graceful district of Naples that is the site of the city's ancient Greek settlement, in an apartment on an upper floor of a palazzo whose hereditary owner, the Principe Garassi, was a client of Ducro's father, a lawyer named Nino Masca. Her mother, Maria Luisa Giordano, was descended from a noble but reduced family. It is family lore that when Ducro's parents met in Capri in the 1920s, her mother may have been working as a courtesan. Her father's legal practice didn't make the family rich, but they nonetheless inhabited bourgeois circles in Naples. Ducro told me that although the city maintained medieval social norms in her youth, with young women requiring a male escort merely to venture outside, "people were fascinated by my mother because she dressed in a way that was very elegant and very free." In an act as spontaneous as Ducro's own work with textiles, her mother would fashion dresses for Ducro and her sister by pinning together curtains. Naples was heavily bombed during the Second World War, and the family left for the relative safety of Sorrento, a seaside retreat along the Bay of Naples, where they occupied the servants' quarters of a villa belonging to an exiled Russian princess. In the evenings, Ducrot and her mother would have tea with the princess on the terrace and gaze at the city across the bay. "I remember my mother saying, 'I see a fire. Perhaps it is near our house,' Ducrot said. 'And our house was bombed, and we lost it.'" When they returned after the war, only one corner of the Palazzo Grassi remained standing, its ornate doorway splintered and its windows blown out. "My father asked the Principe, 'Can I live here with my family?' And he said yes," Ducrot recalled. "Nobody would think to live that way." The family inhabited the ruin as if it were the Palazzo Doria. Her mother created a bathroom in what had once been the library. Ducrot was expected to make a suitable marriage upon graduating from high school. Paolo, her brother, told me everybody looked for her at the beginning of parties and dances. She was known as one of the great beauties of Naples. But when Ducrot was around 17 and having an aperitif at the Excelsior Hotel, she began coughing up blood. "My mouth was invaded by warm liquid," she writes in 22 Places of the Soul. "I was able to slip into the next-door bathroom, let that unstoppable, hot, flowing matter flop into the sink." It was tuberculosis, an unspeakable disease in Naples, which had been blighted by the plague in the 17th century. Ducrot, fearful of being considered tainted, concealed her condition. Every 2 weeks, she sneaked off for a treatment that involved injecting oxygen via a syringe into her rib cage. It took 15 years before she was declared cured. Ducrot was around 30 when she fled the confines of Naples for the freedom of Rome, where nobody knew anything about me. She still relishes the capital's relative anonymity. "In this palazzo, I know about 10 people. I never run into them. For me, it's fantastic." She worked as a receptionist at IBM, at an office on the exclusive Via Veneto, and fell in with a group of intellectuals that overlapped with the likes of the novelist Alberto Moravia and the poet and filmmaker Pier Paolo Pasolini. "They were very chic, very elegant, and very leftist," she said. "I was not on the right or the left. I was nothing. But I was happy with them." It was the era of Fellini's La Dolce Vita, and the women of Rome, married or otherwise, were bolder than those Ducrot had known in Naples. "At least at first," she told me, "I was not a free woman. I did not have lovers." When she finally became involved with a man, a leftist editor, she asked him one day to drive her to church so that she could confess her sins. Ducrot didn't have money to spare and was of necessity resourceful. When she was invited to a dance at the Palazzo Farnese, one of the Rome's greatest palaces, she improvised a dress from a length of fabric, just as her mother had done with curtains. Vicky, who was working for the airline KLM, not far from Isabella's office, began courting her. Vicky was also from the south of Italy, Palermo in his case, but he was wealthy. His family owned a furniture company that made fittings for top hotels and luxury transatlantic liners. One day, Isabella joined him, his sister, Sandra, and several of their friends for a walk in the countryside. A man who had brought along his toddler son was flummoxed when the child soiled his pants and began to cry. Isabella swept the boy into her arms, hitched up her skirt, and waded into a nearby pond, washing him clean until he began laughing. Sandra, now a ceramicist who lives in Paris, told me, "She looked like a goddess, and she did the right thing, and so naturally." Vicky was looking at her, too, and I said, "You ought to marry this woman." A few months later, Vicky proposed. I was not in love, but I needed to be protected, Ducreau recalled, adding that he promised her, you can cry in my arms. She told me this was really what I wanted. He didn't say, you are the best, you are a queen. He said, you are, and it's my joy. Her life changed dramatically in scope and in resources. Vicky's mother gave the newlyweds an apartment in Trastevere, a bohemian neighborhood in Rome, as a wedding gift, and took Ducreau shopping for couture in Paris and for jewels at Bugatti. 16 months after the couple's wedding, Enrico was born, with Giuseppe arriving 18 months after that. Soon after Ducreau married Vicky, she showed him some autobiographical short stories that she had written and textile designs that she had drawn. He was kindly but dismissive, she told me, and Ducreau set such projects aside for decades. I was not offended, she told me. He had the feeling that he was protecting me. It was his way to show love. Instead, she devoted herself to creating a gracious home and to sparking enthusiasm in Vicky, a serial autodidact. She recalled, once I was alone in Florence, and I saw a small Baroque painting, and I called and said, Vicky, I saw a beautiful, interesting painting. And he said, don't buy it. We don't need a Baroque painting. She bought it anyway, and he went on to acquire more than 40 others and immerse himself deeply in that period of art. Vicky's introduction to a published catalog of the Ducreau collection begins with a bracing confession. To collect, and this can be applied to all kinds of collecting, whether matchboxes, playing cards, narwhal teeth, or pipes, implies a desire to own and accumulate property, and ultimately is an expression of egotism and vanity. Vicky was conservative in his politics, but in other ways he was more permissive than many Italian husbands. He loved me, and he let me do what I wanted, Ducreau told me. When she wanted to ride a bicycle around Rome, he told her that it was unsafe, but he turned a blind eye when it became her preferred mode of transportation. Marriage gave Ducreau both security and freedom. I remember that I thought, now that I'm married, I can fall in love with other people, she said. It's very practical. Once Ducreau entered elite Roman society, she found herself surrounded by other men of intelligence and cultivation. Her marriage was long and successful. But she told me that when her friends waxed sentimental about how much she and Vicky must have loved each other, she cuts them off. They are missing the point. I always said Vicky gave me, for 60 years, every day, something to eat. Throughout the Ducreau's marriage, they spent weeks at a stretch traveling. Isabella estimates that she had been to India 60 times and also to numerous places now essentially off-limits to tourists, including Syria. In Afghanistan, she visited the imperial hilltop retreat of Istalif, Pasatana on Hindu Kush. Vicky once described it in a photo album. And the Buddhas of Bamiyan, whose sandstone robes looked to Isabella like vortices of lines. The Taliban destroyed the Buddhas in 2001. During these expeditions, it fell to Isabella to ensure that tour group members were satisfied with their hotel rooms and to supply whiskey sours after a long day of sightseeing. In the course of her travels, she said, I learned many things, and I developed my sensibility. Enrico and Giuseppe occasionally came on these trips, but more typically, they were left behind with babysitters. Ducreau told me that she enjoyed her children, but also cherished her life apart from them. The reality is that I preferred to be with my friends than with them, she explained. It was not my maximum amusement to be with them. If someone wonders aloud to her if the embrace in a Tendernesse's painting represents a mother and a child, she quickly disabuses them. She told me, I always thought that Proust, when the mother went after giving him the goodnight kiss, cried, not because he was so sad that the mother left, but because he understood that she was preparing to amuse herself with much more interesting people than himself. Among her close friends was Patrizia Cavalli, the poet who died 2 years ago. Cavalli once composed a poem for Ducrow titled, in English, To Weave is Human, in which the warp is personified as male and the weft as female. She meets him just to leave him, and leaving him, she meets him. He suffers her, he's blameless, and stands firm in his place. Tatiana Franchetti, the wife of Cy Twombly, and an artist herself, who died in 2010, was the first person to encourage Ducrow to resume a creative life. The very first painting Ducrow made in the 80s, which, with a few strokes of ink on Chinese paper, depicts two reclining lovers, hangs in her living room. Another female friend who encouraged Ducrow's nascent vocation was Christina Bamba, a clothing designer and the owner of a boutique near the Piazza del Popolo. Bamba told me that she was visiting Ducrow's home to peruse her textile collection when she saw a patchwork children's blanket that Ducrow had crafted. I couldn't sleep that night because I was thinking about this blanket, she recalled. Every little piece of fabric was so beautiful, and I was saying to myself, my God, she's so good. She's a genius. Bamba gave Ducrow one of her first artistic commissions to fabricate a screen for her boutique. The object, for which Ducrow patched scraps of silk and rough linen into abstract geometries, remains in service. She started to do exhibitions in Italy, but it was very difficult for years, Bamba went on. In Italy, you have to be poor and unhappy to be an artist. But she was beautiful, and she was one of the luckiest people in Rome because she had everything she wanted. So people didn't believe in her as an artist. Ducrow's studio is a bright, high-ceiling space behind a door that opens into a colonnaded courtyard. All day long, visitors to the Doria Pamphilj Gallery, which is open to the public, walk past it unaware. When I visited the studio, a half-completed Tendernesses painting on Japanese gompi paper lay on the studio's floor. The breasts of a female figure were exposed. A male figure had a peacock-like crest. Her studio assistant of 20 years, Veronica Della Porta, had added a black-and-white checkered background. For the next stage, Ducrow was filling the outlines of the figures with brilliant color, pea green for the women's skirt and carmine for the man's lanky legs, as though he were rearing the hose of a medieval jester. Little by little we go on, Ducrow told me, and the tenderness comes out. On a work table lay a smaller painting that looked closer to completion. On paper washed in rose pink pigment, Ducrow had drawn a couple in a snatched embrace, one with yellow cascading hair, the other with turquoise fronds that radiated outward. Elsewhere in the studio, cabinets were filled with textiles folded like stacks of laundry. In addition to using scraps from her collection, Ducrow sometimes affixes larger, garment-sized pieces to a background, creating imposing shapes suggestive of kimonos or of sultan's robes. Nora Iosia, Ducrow's studio manager, who has worked with her since 1996, unfolded one such work, which was taller than her. Two pieces of blue and white striped Japanese cotton had been placed in bold juxtaposition. Yosia told me that it had taken time for Ducrow to become comfortable with such experiments. When I met Isabella, she was very fragile and insecure, she said. At the time, Yosia herself had recently graduated from college with a degree in literature and philosophy. Her mother, a curator, was familiar with Ducrow and her work. My mother told me, Isabella is an incredible artist, but don't ask her to speak because she doesn't know the language. She needed to find the words. Until Gisella Capitain, the Cologne gallerist, visited the studio with her director, Regina Fiorito, more than three decades after Ducrow began painting, nothing happened at all for her outside of Italy, Iosia said. Isabella was full of power and full of desire, and yet nothing. It was kind of waiting for something. De Crow had been a reader since her late teens, when her illness made it impossible for her to do much more than rest at home with a book. In her 60s, she began to study philosophy in earnest, taking classes at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome and working privately with scholars. With Emmanuel d'Attilo, she spent long hours discussing Simone Martini, the Sienese artist who inspired her exploration of humble checkered cloth. "I appreciate Isabella's study method first and foremost," D'Attilo told me. "It is the method of losing herself, exposing herself to a radical not understanding, and moving forward with courage. Her study of philosophy is of this kind, getting into it and then seeing what effect certain ideas or certain words have on her, above all, emotionally." D'Attilo went on, "What is hidden attracts her. But above all, I think what attracts her is a kind of reversal of roles. She continually wants to reverse high and low." De Crow's work shows a particular interest in ordinary woven materials, the kind, she has written, that are used to protect, wrap, wash, and rub the bodies of newborn babies, of women giving birth, of the elderly, of the sick. Her inclusion of such fabrics in her art rejects the low esteem in which they are typically held, revealing their inherent dignity. Similarly, in Women's Life, she writes of finally considering the endemic ignorance that had tormented me for so many years, not as a source of shame, but instead as an advantage. That shame had made it difficult for De Crow to take herself seriously, not just as an artist, but as a person. For too long, she looked to others to tell her who she was. "I think life for women begins at 60, she told me, "because then we begin to be free." The last day that I spent in Rome, I left De Crow's apartment after we shared a lunch of pink-skinned grilled rouget, sprinkled with herbs and eggplant that had been reduced in the oven to a deliciously sticky tar. Afterward, she wanted to take a nap, as she does most afternoons. Tucked into a corner of her study is a monastic single bed, alongside which hangs a Bazzizio painting of Christ as Salvator Mundi, the arrangement resembling the bedchamber of a priest or perhaps even a pope. When I returned, a few hours later, De Crow admitted that she had not slept after all, but instead had sifted through old letters. She found one from a man she had been deeply in love with during her Naples youth. This man, named Antonello, had come up many times in our conversation, flashing into view like the checkered lining on a cloak worn by an annunciating angel. He had rejected her, she had told me, and it had been a torment. Antonello had written the letter she was holding when he was in his early 20s and she was 18. "It says how desperate he was, because I wanted to leave him," she explained. "I had forgotten completely. I remembered that I loved him, and that's all." The letter, which ran to several typed pages, subverted the narrative that De Crow had long told herself about having been spurned. "In that moment, he really loved me," she said with fresh wonderment. "And I have loved him for years and years. So I forgot that he could have loved me." The fabric of her old story was coming apart in her hands. "The discovery felt transformative," De Crow said. "You came at a moment of my life when there is not so much more to say and not so much more to feel," she noted. "So every day from tomorrow, I cannot say another life begins. No, certainly not. But, in a way, perhaps, another meaning of the life is beginning." Earlier, she had wanted to assure me of how unpredictable a very long life might be. Although I told her that I'd been happily married for 20 years, she observed, "We don't know what we are going to do in life. Perhaps you will become a dancer, or leave your family, or go off with a man from South Africa. not exactly conventional wisdom from an elder. Now, she told me, she believed it was possible to fall in love even as one was dying. I have always thought this, that you are dying in a kind of agony and you fall in love, she said. I'm sure it has happened. The letter in her hand, written on the fragile paper of the past, was the material evidence not just of what she had experienced in her youth, but of what was animating her at this moment, our intense, extended conversation. Being very old had heightened her sense of the present. I am already in love with you, she told me in greeting on the first evening I visited. If Ducrow had wisdom to impart, it concerned the trembling imperative of living fully, even without a future. I think a person of my age cannot not be interesting, she said, because we are like prisoners in a jail, and we know that we are in the Brazo de la Muerte, on death row. She went on, this is true of everybody, good people, intelligent people, poor people, rich people. This is an experience to be so old. Lately, Ducrow has developed a new practice in her work. She takes pages of writing by others, which have long been filed away in cupboards and drawers, and sews pieces of them onto the surface of paintings. Not for their content, she told me, but because of the beauty of their now illegible calligraphy. In her hands, these texts were transformed from one thing into another, just like the textiles that she once gathered from faraway places. One of Ducrow's newest works lay on the dining table during my visit, and one morning I snapped a photograph of the painting on my phone. Only later did I take it in more fully. On a large fabric background, she had painted leaf-covered trees and an array of pots containing brightly colored, heavy-headed flowers. Tacked in the middle of the work was a cutout from a piece of paper on which tiny cursive letters had been written. The cutout was encircled by the branching arm of a tree. The leaves were heart-shaped and an autumnal brown, barely still attached to a branch, or perhaps no longer attached at all, but suspended in an ultimate moment of lightness before their fall. Next, from the July 28, 2014 edition of the New Yorker magazine, The Annals of Alimentation Department, Stone Soup by Elizabeth Colbert. The first day I put my family on a Paleolithic diet, I made my kids fried eggs and sausage for breakfast. If they were still hungry, I told them they could help themselves to more sausage, but they were not allowed to grab a slice of bread or toast, an English muffin, or pour themselves a bowl of cereal. This represented a reversal of the usual strictures, and they were happy to oblige. It was like some weird, unexpected holiday, Passover in July. The Paleolithic diet, paleo, for those in the know, represents a new, very old form of eating, one confined to the sorts of food available in pre-agricultural days. These foods, as it happens, were not many. According to Sarah Ballantyne, the author of The Paleo Approach, a paleo diet consists of meats, fish, eggs, vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds. According to John Durant, the author of The Paleo Manifesto, even seeds are suspect and should be avoided. The list of foods that are not paleo, meanwhile, is a great deal longer. It includes cereal grains like wheat, corn, and rice, pseudo-cereal grains like amaranth and quinoa, legumes, dairy products, most vegetable oils, sugar, and anything that contains corn syrup or artificial coloring or flavorings or preservatives, which is to say just about everything a contemporary American consumes. Most days, my kids pack their own lunches, but since I had banned the standard ingredients, starting with the bread for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, I figured I was obligated to step in. I rolled up some turkey slices and arranged them in a plastic container with some cut-up avocados. Then I gave each kid a banana and some paleo cookies I had made using ground-up almonds. The cookies looked a little like hamburgers and tasted like sawdust. There are, of course, lots of ways to resist progress. People take up knitting or quilting or calligraphy. They bake their own bread or brew their own beer or sew their own clothes using felt they have fashioned out of wet wool and dish soap. But both in the scale of its ambition and the scope of its anachronism, paleo eating takes things to a whole new level. Our Stone Age ancestors left behind no menus or cookbooks. To figure out what they ate, we have to dig up their bones and study the wear patterns on their teeth, or comb through their refuse and analyze their prehistoric poop. And paleo eating is just the tip of the spear, so to speak. There are passionate advocates for paleo fitness, which starts with tossing out your sneakers. There's a paleo sleep contingent, which recommends blackout curtains, amber-tinted glasses, and getting rid of your mattress. And there are champions of primal parenting, which may or may not include eating your baby's placenta. There are even signs of a paleo hygiene movement. Coat yourself with bacteria and say goodbye to soap and shampoo. The result is a small library of what might be called paleo literature, how-to books that are mostly how-to-undo books. Such is the tenor of our time that the ultimate retro movement is lavishly represented on the web. From a site called Paleo Grubs, I downloaded recipes for delicious paleo carrot cake muffins and paleo apple nachos. And from a site called Nom Nom Paleo, I got instructions on how to make paleo Krabby Patties and civilized caveman's apple cinnamon cookies. All of these dishes rely heavily on ingredients, including flour made from coconuts, a quirk that reminded me of Gilligan's Island and its many coconut shell contraptions. 3 days into my family's experiment in Stone Age eating, my sons were still happily gorging themselves on sausage and grass-fed steak. My husband was ruminating on the tenuousness of existence, and probably true to the actual Paleolithic experience, I found that I was spending more and more time preparing the few foods that we could eat. Agriculture was invented several times in different parts of the world by people making use of the plants they found growing wild among them. The first time was probably about 10,000 years ago in southeastern Turkey, when early farmers began cultivating einkorn wheat. The crop was a big hit, and, at least by the standards of the day, it spread rapidly. This is sometimes referred to as the big agricultural bang. Wheat was being sown in Greece around 8,000 years ago, in the Balkans and in Italy 7,000 years ago, and in India and Scandinavia 5,000 years ago. Meanwhile, around 9,000 years ago, a group of proto-farmers in southwestern Mexico began cultivating maize. It, too, quickly caught on and was being grown in Panama 7,000 years ago and in Colombia 6,000 years ago. Also, sometime around 9,000 years ago, rice was domesticated in the Yangtze Valley. In the standard account of human history, agriculture represents the UR breakthrough. The domestication of plants and animals allowed people for the first time to build up surpluses of food. This, in turn, allowed them to think about something besides feeding themselves. They became merchants and priests and artisans and bookkeepers. They built villages, towns, and cities. Every subsequent innovation, metallurgy, writing, mathematics, science, and even paleo websites, could be said to owe its origin to those first farmers scratching with sticks in the dirt. Agro-revisionists also regard the Neolithic Revolution as a critical event. They, too, believe that without it, modern society wouldn't exist. What they're not so sure about is whether it was a good idea. The adoption of agriculture, supposedly our most decisive step toward a better life, was in many ways a catastrophe from which we have never recovered, is Jared Diamond's dour assessment offered in an essay titled The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race. Like Stone Age hunter-gatherers, early farmers left little behind, just some burnt grain, mud foundations, and their own bones. But that's enough to reveal how punishing the transition to agriculture was. According to a study of human remains from China and Japan, the height of the average person declined by more than 3 inches during the millennia in which rice cultivation intensified. According to another study of bones from Mesoamerica, women's heights drop by 3 inches and men's by 2 inches as farming spread. A recent survey of more than 20 studies on this subject, published in the journal Economics and Human Biology, found that the adoption of agriculture was observed to decrease stature in populations from across the entire globe, including in Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and South America. Early farmers were not just shorter than hunter-gatherers, they were also more sickly. They had worse teeth. One analysis from the Near East suggests that the incidence of cavities jumped sixfold as people started relying on grain, and they suffered from increased rates of anemia and infectious disease. Many now familiar infections, measles for instance, require high population densities to persist. Thus, it wasn't until people established towns and cities that such crowd epidemic diseases could flourish. And by living in close proximity to their equally crowded farm animals, early agriculturalists helped to bring into being a whole set of diseases that jumped from livestock to people. The adoption of agriculture, Diamond notes in his most recent book, The World Until Yesterday, provided ideal conditions for the rapid transmission of microbes. According to Daniel E. Lieberman, a professor of evolutionary biology at Harvard and the author of The Story of the Human Body, farming ushered in an era of epidemics including tuberculosis, leprosy, syphilis, plague, smallpox, and influenza. It took thousands of years for human bodies to recover. Lieberman reports that it wasn't until the 20th century that Europeans were the same height as cavemen. And almost as soon as the stature gap closed, new problems arose. People began to grow not just taller, but also wider. During the past several decades, rates of obesity, hypertension, fatty liver disease, and type 2 diabetes have soared. The increases were first noted in the United States, but now that French fries and Coke have gone global, nations ranging from Mexico to Mauritius have seen similar, indeed in some cases worse, surges. Today, the highest prevalence of diabetes is in Tokelau, a territory of New Zealand in the South Pacific, where nearly 40% of adults are afflicted. Lieberman calls conditions like type 2 diabetes mismatched diseases. Our ancestors hunted and gathered, we drive to Shake Shack and Domino's. The result is a mismatch between our genetics and our lifestyles. I don't think it's possible to overemphasize just how important mismatched diseases are, Lieberman writes. You are most likely going to die from a mismatched disease. Paleo may look like a food fad, and yet you could argue that it's really just the reverse. Anatomically, modern humans have, after all, been around for about 200,000 years. The genus Homo goes back another 2 million years or so. On the timescale of evolutionary history, it's agriculture that's the fad. During our week of paleo, I made several trips to the nearest Stop and Shop, a hanger-sized affair that sells something like 40,000 different items. In the store's vast midsection, which is given over to processed confections, there's aisle after aisle of salty snacks, soft drinks, sport drinks, breakfast cereals, followed by more aisles of sugary snacks, candy bars, packages of multiple candy bars and cookies. One afternoon, as I was pushing my cart along, searching for shredded coconut, it occurred to me that my Paleolithic ancestors would have had a hard time recognizing anything in these rows as food. Probably they would have had an easier time over in the produce section, but here, too, they would have found plenty to baffle them. What we know as apples, from the tree Malus domestica, are the products of hundreds of generations of careful breeding that started with the tree Malus sieversii, native to Central Asia. The author Michael Pollan once described the fruit of Malus sieversii as tasting like a tart potato, or alternatively like a Brazil nut sheathed in leather. Avocados, a staple of many paleo menus, have similarly been transfigured. The originals consisted of just a thin layer of flesh surrounding a giant seed. And what goes for apples and avocados also goes for broccoli, bananas, and Brussels sprouts. It's also probably true of coconuts, though by now domesticated coconut palms have been so widely cultivated that there are hardly any truly wild ones left. Similarly, the meat cases in our supermarkets are stacked with bits and pieces of animals reshaped by human appetites. Beef cattle and dairy cows, too, are descended from aurochs, which were much larger and fiercer animals. Our oaks, for their part, are no longer to be had for the same reason that moas, mammoths, and mastodons are unavailable. Our ancestors hunted them to oblivion. Both on their websites and in their many, many guidebooks, proponents of the paleo diet make all sorts of claims for its efficacy. Some contend that it cures autoimmune diseases, others that it reverses diabetes. Durant maintains that it cleared up his acne. The most common assertion is that it's good for losing weight, which I can believe. I spent most of my week on a paleo diet feeling as if I'd swallowed a wildebeest. Meanwhile, nearly every paleo dish I prepared, beyond straight-up meat and vegetables, was a flop. An attempt at pancakes ended up mostly in the compost, as did a batch of muffins. Paleo adepts will doubtless argue that a week is not enough to experience the diet's full benefits, and that I did not approach the enterprise in the right spirit. The last time most of humanity followed, by necessity, a paleo diet, there were maybe 5 million people on the planet. Yet already they were having a big impact. It's been theorized that one of the impetuses for the development of agriculture was that large, easy-to-kill prey were becoming harder to find. As grain growing spread, it produced what's been called the first population explosion. Whether or not agriculture was the worst mistake in the history of the human race, the choice once made was made for good. With a global population of 7 billion people heading rapidly toward 8 billion, there's certainly no turning back now, even if paleo does, in fact, prevent SITs. Pound for pound, beef production demands at least 10 times as much water as wheat production, and calorie for calorie, it demands almost 20 times as much energy. Livestock are major sources of greenhouse gas emissions, not just because of the fuel it takes to raise them, but also because they do things like belch out methane and produce lots of manure, which in turn produces lots of nitrous oxide. One analysis, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, concluded that in terms of emissions, eating a pound of beef is equivalent to driving 45 miles. Eating a pound of whole wheat, by contrast, is like driving less than a mile. All of which is to say that, from an environmental standpoint, paleo's let-them-eat-steak approach is a disaster. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.